يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series taking a close look at the Middle East, North Africa region.
Hello and a very warm welcome to a Middle East Analysis special. Special because we haven't broadcast one in goodness knows how long. Now, when I utter those words, Middle East Analysis, you can probably have a reasonably good guess as to who is sitting in the chair opposite me. That is, was, remains, our regular studio contributor, the international lawyer, expert on the Middle East, North Africa region, I would say, although he may be a little bit more modest, and the Gulf states, Dr. Harry Hagopian. How are you?
James, it is a bizarre feeling sitting here in the studio with you and recording this special episode of Middle East Analysis. We haven't done it for a long time, so I'd lost
the will to live.
The will to live is there. That's part of my faith. I'm talking about circumstances. And it's nice to be back here and to be reacquainted with your inner bowel.
Good grief. I don't know how to respond to that. So instead of responding to that, I will also say that we have another very important guest in the studio, our chair of the International Affairs Department, and, of course, was formerly the chair of the Holy Land Coordination, Bishop Declan Lang. Bishop Declan, how are you?
I'm well. It's good to be back here. Good to see Harry and to listen to him. He's always got an insight into the whole situation that nobody else has.
I thought you were going to say he always has plenty to say, which would also be fair, I think.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with saying something so long as it is relevant. And that's what lawyers do. Their tool is the word. And you introduced Bishop Declan as chair of international affairs, mm-hmm. formerly chair of the Holy Land Coordination. I would add something, if I may, because
please.
He and I haven't seen each other for a very long time. So I would insist on also calling him a friend.
Too right, absolutely.
Thank you, Harry.
Absolutely. Bishop Declan, let's start with you. Now, obviously, you know, we've seen heartbreaking scenes, particularly in the Holy Land, particularly in Gaza, since the Hamas terror attack of the 7th of October, and then the subsequent humanitarian disaster, I think is possibly an understatement, that has carried through into Gaza. It must be very difficult from you, having been into that small strip many, many times, to look upon the events that are unfolding.
Yes, Gaza was a sad condition before any of this happened. It's now a tragic situation. And one is almost lost for words to be able to describe the horror of it.
Yeah.
And what those people must be undergoing needs our support and sympathy and our help.
And we've seen many projects, haven't we? The times I've only been in once, but nonetheless, we, you know, in better, although difficult days, we have seen that small Catholic community of under 100 punching well above its weight and seemingly now in this hour of great need, supporting an awful lot of the local community in that north bit of Gaza that's almost a no-go zone.
Yes, the compound, the Christian compound, is a place of refuge. But they've been hit by rockets and they've had two people shot by a sniper. And they've run out of food. And they say now that they're really frightened, terrified, the fact that they're going to be destroyed altogether.
And Harry, that is the terrain that sadly we stare upon at the moment. People that have been moved twice, being asked potentially to move again. The north of the Gaza Wadi, where obviously we have that compound of the Holy Family. I am almost lost for words, but, you know, what can we say about the potential for aid getting through, the situation improving, or is it going to get worse before it gets better?
You know, before I answer that, James, let me say that in a sense you introduce me as an expert. I don't believe in the word expert because nobody is really an expert. We sort of make it as we go along. We're all sitting at the edge of our seats trying to figure out what will happen next, whether that is in Gaza, whether that is in the West Bank of Palestine, whether that is across the whole Middle East, North Africa region. But what is interesting to me also is the fact that you also mentioned something quite relevant. Bishop Declan has been in Gaza many, many times recently, heading the Holy Land Coordination pilgrimages that the Catholic Church puts together internationally every January.
Mm-hmm.
You have been there once. I used to go to Gaza with my family to eat fish because they had some very fresh fish there in some very nice restaurants. However, I haven't been there for a very long time, whereas I've been quite often to the West Bank, to Jordan, to other parts of the MENA region. So in a visual, physical sense, Bishop Declan, and perhaps even you, know more the topography of Gaza, say, 5 years ago, than I would. However, relying on what I know of Gaza and what I've seen in Gaza when I've been there, and also knowing a little bit the geopolitics of the region, I would only say something very simple. Political leaders across the West, from the United States to the UK, from France to Italy, are trying to sort of come up with new words and new concepts. But the fact remains that in the last 5 months, after the 7th of October, when the war started against Gaza on the 9th of October, that strip, whether north of the Wadi, where the churches are, or south of the Wadi, has been devastated, decimated. There is nothing that works there. There is absolutely nothing. So much of the houses, institutions, buildings have been attacked and they have crumbled. There is starvation now, according to UNICEF and according to many other UN organizations, not least UNRWA, which is being maligned, in my opinion, unfairly. And there is also a lot of disease around in Gaza. You've got hepatitis, you've got the beginnings of cholera. So 2 million people are basically facing a nightmare. And it is a nightmare which we in the West don't really understand, because we have never faced something like that, except if we go to the second big war, the World War. But they are facing this every day. And I saw yesterday a woman, an ordinary woman in Gaza, who is enclosed in that 16-kilometer cage in Rafah, adjoining the Egyptian border, and one of the Al Jazeera Arab journalists, and they're the only journalists allowed in the strip, asked her, "What would you like next?" And she said, "You know what? I don't like this idea of gradually killing us all one by one. Let them just drop one big bomb so we end this misery that we are living." This is what Gaza is. And to equate that and say we cannot talk about this because of the terror that took place on the 7th of October in the Gaza envelope is, in my opinion, not only disingenuous, but also dehumanizes how we define humanity.
I'm going to come back to you, Harry, and ask you a very big question about the lack of progress when it comes to peace, or a lasting peace between Israelis and Palestinians over the last 30 years since the Oslo Accords. So you get thinking about that, because it is a bit of a big question.
I will.
And Bishop Declan, I'm struck by, obviously, for us, it's about being on the side of the human, isn't it? The suffering human. And I think back to those, Harry mentioned, sort of punctuated his point there with those individual human realities. And I remember a little boy, you may or may not remember this, when 2017, when I went in, I had the video camera filming, you know, the mass, but also filming the projects in Khan Yunis and other places. And this little boy kept taking my camera off me, which I thought was, you know, I tolerated it. It was quite sweet. I thought he might not have played around with a £1,200 camera, so why not? And he did my filming. He filmed the procession. He was filming in that compound that you mentioned in Gaza City. And somebody sent me the picture of him the other day, where I'm standing by him with the tripod and the camera. And in 2017, he looked about 9 years old. And so fast forward, you think that's a 16-year-old young man now. And is he still alive? And I was looking at that picture and I got quite tearful, actually. And it's those things that sort of strike you about the human realities, aren't they?
Yes. I remember a young man, he asked what he wanted. And he said, "All I wanted is to be respected as a human being." Because the Palestinians, not only in Gaza, but in the West Bank, feel that they're not regarded as equal human beings, as others are. And it's a human tragic story. And it goes against the whole dignity of humanity. It's a failure in human communication and relationships. it's by no means sort of seen each other as brothers and sisters. It's sort of seen each other as superior and inferior. I can understand, for instance, the people rushing to get food for their families because they've been starving and, you know, attacking the lorries that are bringing the food in. To be starving is an experience which we just don't have. We're hungry. We don't starve in this country.
Yeah, it's like Harry was saying, isn't it, about the sort of our tolerance for such things and our exposure to such things since the Second World War. It's probably the pandemic where we struggled, for instance, for toilet paper on shelves. That might have been our, you know, pressure point in recent times. And really, it just pales into insignificance when you look at those human realities. I just wanted to ask you, Bishop Declan, there is a day of prayer that Cardinal Vincent called for on Friday, the 8th of March, one of our Fridays in Lent, so a penitential time anyway. What do you think we can focus our prayers on for the people of the Holy Land at this time?
I focus on the community of Holy Family Church and focus on the suffering of the children everywhere throughout the land. I think one of the saddest things is seeing all these babies born and dying. I think it's also a religious question arises amongst people of their own country. The question is, again, I was asked the other day, can there be a God if this goes on? And it's a very good question. And it's a question which I understand people are answering. And all I can say is, especially in the season of Lent, we look to the cross and the crucifixion to try and find some meaning of suffering. The suffering of Jesus leads to the resurrection. And I think the people of the Holy Lands are going through a crucifixion at the moment. And there's little hope of resurrection for many of them, in their own hearts and minds. But the Christian community has to proclaim reconciliation. And the other thing is to take St. Matthew quite seriously when Jesus says, you must love your enemies. Well, that's quite easy for us to do when our enemies are far away, when your enemies are bombing you. How does it feel to those people to hear, you must love your enemies and pray for them who persecute you?
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it? Because when we look at the local church, and in particular the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, Pier Battista Pizzaballa, Cardinal, His Eminence, that's very much his line, isn't it? I read his Lenten message, which was, until we change the language of hate, the language of vengeance, and adopt a better language, one of reconciliation and peace, then really things won't change. And I think that segues us quite nicely, Harry, into that big question of why things haven't changed. I know you were involved in the Oslo Accords in the 90s. That seems a very long time ago now. Three decades, there have been ups and downs. I've even heard you being positive once or twice in the past, less so recently for obvious reasons. Big question. Why has there been little or no progress since the 90s?
That's a very good question, James. And I will jump into this in a tick. Just wanted to say that there are three words in Gaza in Arabic, but I'll say the English version, that are basically doing the rounds. They very much lift up what Bishop Declan was just saying now, particularly about St. Matthew. The first one is dignity. Palestinians want dignity, and they don't have dignity the way they are dealt. Palestinians have always sought justice. Because, as a former Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem would say, there can be no peace if there is no justice. But the word that is most prevalent these days amongst Arabs and Palestinians in general is dehumanization, that their humanity has been attacked, and the way they're dealt with is as subhumans. In fact, one of the Israeli ministers in the Netanyahu government called them human animals. So that is basically where they are. Now, you ask me a very big question, which needs an episode all to itself, but I'll try and summarize it with two or three points. Why haven't we made any headway, any progress, since I was involved in the Track 2 negotiations of Oslo? One, it is a fact that neither the Israeli-Jewish side nor the Palestinian side see each other's trauma. They're both caged in, wrapped up in their own trauma. One is the Holocaust and one is the Nakba, or the Great Catastrophe, where in 1948, upon the creation of the State of Israel, not least because we in the UK facilitated, midwifed that state in 1948. 750,000 Palestinians lost their homes, their lives, and their livelihoods. So they are still unable to talk to each other because the Israeli cannot understand the Palestinian trauma and the Palestinian cannot appreciate the Israeli trauma. That's one. And it's still ongoing. And so long as you don't heal that trauma or know how to manage that trauma, it's very difficult to talk to your foe or your enemy. The second point I would say is that in the 1990s, when I was involved with second track negotiations, and the Oslo process is now, as I describe it, much maligned, people then, whether Israelis or Palestinians or Arabs in general from different perspectives, were fighting over land. Now they are fighting for God. Not for land, for God. If you look at the proto-fascist ministers in the Netanyahu government, they are basically on a religious crusade. That's what they are. They think that this is their biblical right, that they have to own all this land and exclude all Palestinians or Arabs, be they Muslims or Christians. It doesn't matter ethnicity either. So at the time, we were fighting for land, and it's much easier to fight for land because you can say, you could take this patch, I take that patch. Now they're fighting for God. It's almost a Sisyphean prospect to be able to come to an agreement when your God and my God are different gods. That's the second point I'll make. And the third point I'll make, bringing it forward to the 5 months of war and since the terror attack on the 7th of October, people have been saying to me, and they keep saying to me all the time, Harry, can you imagine Joe Biden, the American president, being so one-sided, being 100% lock, stock, and barrel with the Israeli narrative and against the Palestinian or Arab narrative? I mean, he's throwing little morsels here and there to the Palestinians, but from day one, he said, I'm not a Jew, but I'm a Zionist. So why is he doing this? And I don't think that Joe Biden, who is one of the most experienced politicians on the American scene at the moment, is not only doing it because of this great sense of belonging to the Zionist mentality or ideology. He's also doing it because he thought, and this is his mistake, he thought that by embracing Netanyahu after the 7th of October and showing how America stood shoulder with shoulder with the Israeli trauma that really shook up the whole Israeli society. It was the largest trauma since the Holocaust for Israel and for the Jews. By embracing Israel and the Jewish people, he would then be able to get them to accept his ideas of how to lead to a solution to the conflict between Israel and Palestine. Hence his ideas of let's have a two-state solution. His ideas, or Kamala Harris's, the Veep's idea recently, let's get more humanitarian aid in. He didn't count on Netanyahu saying no to all these overtures. And the fact that he went and hugged him in Israel for Netanyahu is not important because Netanyahu's ideology excludes this kind of tough love. So these are the 3 points I would say in a very, very compressed nutshell or crushed nutshell, if you want, about why we haven't been making any headway or any progress. When there is no goodwill and good faith, you can't move forward. And why not? Well, I gave you 3 examples as to why this hasn't happened.
It struck me in Jerusalem one year, you've got 2 communities so near to one another, and yet so far away from one another, and the trust has just broken down.
Trust has totally broken down, Bishop, and what happens is that when Israel built that illegal separation wall that snakes through the West Bank, because we're talking about Gaza, let's not forget what's happening in the West Bank. People are being detained, arrested, killed. Israel moves in and out of Area A, which is supposed to be strictly Palestinian, according to the, again, much maligned Oslo process. they're using it as if it's their backyard. They can go in and out and do whatever they want. So that wall shields most Israelis from the reality of what is happening on the other side of the wall. And they're saying to themselves, you know what? We're having a booming economy. We're one of the IT technology countries of the world. We are okay. Our GDP is fine. We've got the military. The West is always ready to support us no matter what. Why should we worry about those pesky Palestinians who want self-determination and a state of their own? And it is that myth that you can do away with Palestine and the Palestinians and still get on, be that with normalization with Arab states, be that by ignoring Palestine, has been totally shattered by the 7th of October attack. And that attack has brought front and center the Palestinian conflict and has shown to the world that if you really want peace in that neck of the woods, you have to deal with the Palestinians first. Hence, we go back to the rehumanization through dignity and justice.
Now, I don't know if this is because I've only been a couple of times to the Holy Land, but all the Israelis I've met have been actually kind, generous, and in favor of treating Palestinians as the humans they are. Have I just had a rather narrow exposure? I mean, I'd imagine most people have a good humanitarian heart. Is that naivety?
Most Israeli Jews, and I've known many, many of them, and as you know, I speak the language and I know the people there, many of them are decent people. They're fun to be with. I used to go to Erev Shabbat meals on Friday evenings with Jewish families in Jerusalem. But when it comes to the issue of Palestine, there is a stumbling block there. That's the first thing I'll say. The second thing I will say is that the whole Israeli society, since the Oslo days, which is three decades back, has shifted to the right. So the left has become center, the center has become right, the right has become extreme right. And therefore, that kind of thing you're talking about, you really have to go with a microscope to find it today. And particularly after the 7th of October, which is why I was talking earlier on in this episode about the trauma, the Israeli society has been so shaken up, so astounded by what happened, really to their core. This is not make-believe. This is really them saying that this was their Armageddon, that they cannot anymore think of dealing with the Palestinians. And this is a gift for Netanyahu, whose ideology has always been destroy the possibility of two-state solutions, destroy the possibility of a homeland for the Palestinians. All he wants to do is keep the land, get rid of the people, and manage an occupation. You call it what you will. And the ICJ, the International Court of Justice hearings that I saw, which basically dealt with the first time a case by South Africa against Israel, and then a second one on the hearings to decide, is occupation illegal? Which I thought was funny, because we all know instinctively that when I occupy your land, surely that's not legal. All this proves that we're at a deadlock, and that is the deadlock that we're talking about, that the bishop lifted up and that I'm sort of corroborating, which is dehumanization, that the Palestinians don't deserve it. Who are the Palestinians? Golda Meir in the 1970s, one of the first prime ministers of Israel after independence, who came from Ukrainian background, she said, Palestinian? What Palestinian? That narrative has not changed. And with Netanyahu, whose whole political future is staked on not having a Palestinian state, Biden going and hugging him, or Blinken going out and in and out of the country, is not going to be the answer. The answer is to say this has to happen and to find the means for this to happen. And I'm going to jump into something, if you and the bishop would allow me, because you didn't ask me and you might have asked me. What next? Are we in a hopeless situation?
You've done what you always do, which is to preempt and then go ahead and answer your own question.
There you go. I preempted and I asked the question and I'll answer it, and the bishop is smiling. It's not hopeless. Because even if it is hopeless, if we want to look at it from my own Christian faith,
We're in the Lenten period. You have the crucifixion. But if you don't believe in a resurrection, the crucifixion and the whole story is redundant. When it comes to the occupation and to Israel-Palestine, if you look at a couple of instances only, when Chairman Yasser Arafat, before the actual president of the Palestinian Authority, was still alive, there was a war where the Iraqi president attacked Kuwait. The West and George Bush Sr. at the time made a first war in the Gulf in order to get the Iraqis out of Kuwait and to liberate Kuwait. Why? Because of the oil fields. At that time, Yasser Arafat, through good judgment, ill judgment, I don't know, supported Iraq and not Kuwait. The consequence was, with all the Palestinians working in Kuwait, were kicked out of Kuwait, and rightly so. If your leadership says that I'm with your enemy, why should I give you money and a work? So they all lost their jobs. And everybody said Yasser Arafat did a big mistake by actually siding with Iraq. The Palestinian situation is over. That's it. Finito la musica. It's going to be the end of the Palestinian dream that has been there for decades and decades. Guess what? 6 months later, after that nadir, after that low point, the Madrid conference was convened, which brought back hope again into the process. I'll give you another example. During the Intifada, everybody said, with Sharon there, no way, Ariel Sharon, no way that the Intifada is going to lead to any communication between Palestinians and Israelis. Guess what? After the Intifada, what happened? Sharon and Israel withdrew the settlements from Gaza. And Gaza now became the mess that it is, partly because for 16 years now, Israel has closed it, and the bishop knows this better than me because he's been there recently, hermetically sealed as an open-air cage, and also the misrule and misappropriation by some Palestinian factions who, through a quest for power and corruption, have actually misruled or mismanaged the strip. We are in the mess that we are now. But these are paradigms that could be used to say that even if we are now in this hugely difficult situation, there is still hope that an initiative somehow will come together, but it's going to be difficult. However, I hope that the World Committee, and that includes churches, because churches, some churches have been outspoken, some churches have been timorous. The situation is bad, but there is always hope. And I'm hopeful that this will lead to something, because otherwise the 30,000, it's way more than 30,000 deaths in Gaza. Hospitals decimated, schools decimated, no food, no medicine, all this. If we can finally turn the corner, then I will say hallelujah, amen. But if we leave it where we are, and then the West covers it up with some words, and then the UN Security Council is totally impotent, in a few years' time, we're going to have the same. And that is, to me, a definition of dehumanization, as well as removing the rights of a people for their own independence.
Now, Bishop Declan, you had a plan for the Diocese of Clifton, which I remember was called to be a people of hope.
And that's right.
That phrase seems to be quite appropriate off the back of what Harry's just said, some very strong words there. How do you think, you're getting the final word, of course, how do you think we can be people of hope in this staggeringly difficult reality?
I think if we are people of reconciliation, if we are reconciled to each other in this country, reconciled to the different communities that make this a nation, transfer that into our concern and our love for our neighbour. We're called to be good neighbours, and that's the first stage of evangelisation, to be a good neighbour. And it shows in Palestine and Israel it's difficult to be a good neighbour. But if we try to be good neighbours, and there are good people around in Palestine and Israel, then if we work on that, there's the way forward, I think. there is resurrection, because we are called to be a people of hope.
Harry, Bishop Declan, thank you so much for your time. It's been a while for all three of us, certainly since we've all been in front of a mic simultaneously. But Harry, a long time since we have. I'd like to thank you very much for coming in and doing this Middle East analysis special. And Bishop Declan, it's always a pleasure, of course. Thank you very much for coming in. And let's hope there is something we can be more positive about in the future. But as you say, let's remain people of hope, focus our prayers on that beloved holy land of ours, and we'll just have to offer it to the Lord on the cross.
And you know what? Thanks to you for getting this studio up and running again for Middle East analysis. We haven't had it for a long time. Maybe we can have a part two for the details of some of what is happening. But I also want to say it's a blast, a real blast, to be here, the three of us, with Bishop Declan. It takes me back to pre-pandemic days.
Oh, yes.
If that is not hope, then what is?
Very well said. Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed.